on October 31st, 1986, interviewing Robert Hawkins at his home on the Hotchkiss campus. Robert, when did you come to Lakeville?
My very first trip here was in late June of 1945, and then I came as a master at the Hotchkiss School in the very first of September in 1945, and have been here ever since.
Where were you born?
I was born in Highmore, South Dakota.
How did you get to Lakeville?
Well, make a long story very, very short. I was born and brought up on the edge of an Indian reservation, and we called him Superintending Presbyter, the rector of our Episcopal Church, was really a missionary church, was a graduate of Trinity College, and he thought Trinity College would be a good place for me, and so I went to Trinity College in Hartford on his recommendation. And then when I was graduated, I wasn't quite sure what to do, and somebody suggested teaching, and somebody else suggested applying at the Hotchkiss School, and I did, and here I am.
That's great. We're all confused about the big Scoble family. Can you shed any light on all the people in it?
I think I can do pretty well. The original Scoville to move here was Nathaniel Scoville. The family came from out near Buffalo, and they made their original money in wagon wheels for trains. And although there are some myths concerning other ways they made their money, one that one of Nathaniel Scoville's granddaughters loved to perpetuate, and I'll tell you about that presently, I think that's where the fortune began, and it was a very large fortune indeed. Mr. Scoville had a house in New York, but his wife remained here most of the time, and the house on Taconic Road, which was latterly owned by the Markins and now by somebody with an Armenian name, I don't know the name, that house was built and then burned down and was rebuilt. And that was where all the Scoville children were reared, and there were six of them. Two sons, and they were I've forgotten exactly the order in which they came. I think the oldest of all the Scovilles was Gracie, who never married. And the youngest of them all was Lois Warner. And in between were Robert, who was the treasurer of the Hotchkiss School for years, and Herbert, who married Orlena Zabriskie of Brooklyn, and Robert, whose first wife I never knew. I knew his second wife. His first wife died, and they had one daughter named Margot. And then there was Lois, who married Don Warner, and she had five children, Don and Jonathan, and three daughters, Frances, the two names will come to me presently, I've forgotten them. Herbert Scoville and Orlena had two children. The older is Elvia, and the younger, Herbert Scoville Jr., everybody called Pete. And then there was Edie Scoville, who never married, and Mary Frances Scoville, who about age 42 married John McChesney, who had been a master at Hotchkiss for several years at the time they were married. The family lived very fashionably indeed, and had these two large houses here. When Mother Scoville, she was called, the wife of Nathaniel Scoville, died, that house was taken over by the older of the two sons, Robert. And then Herbert and his wife built a house, which is now, let me go back a minute. Their first house is on the property where their second house, Hill House, is located. Their first house was a building while they were on a year honeymoon around the world, and when it was almost completed, it burned, and they had to start all over again. And everybody says the result was a very happy plan. I saw pictures of the original house, and it was not very imaginative. It was somewhat like the other old house that still stands on Taconic Road. And Orlena Scoville was a person of exquisite taste. She had marvelous taste in what she collected, what she wore, what she said, and whom she knew. And She went to Portugal in 1935 and bought a 13th century quinta that belonged to one of the Portuguese kings and was in great disrepair, and she bought it and restored it and was subsequently decorated by the Portuguese government for her work on that house. Sir Osbert Sitwell, in one of his books on Portugal, mentions at some length the house, which is called Bacalhau, except we referred to Mrs. Scoville as Mrs. Schofield all the time, but it really was Orlena Scoville. The McChesneys never had any children. They were married relatively late in life. You want to stop for a minute?
Sure.
Gracie and Edie were just marvelous people. Gracie had a very bass kind of voice and was blunt in her manner, but she was a person of great generosity and great kindness, as all the Scovilles have been. They're really a remarkable family. Edie had a little squeaky kind of voice, but she was a marvelous person and did all sorts of kind things. They maintained the Barak Matif farm where Ollie Argall now lives, their grandniece, and it was a real operating farm. As a matter of fact, the Scoville brothers had lots of farmland. A farm on Route 41 called, forgotten what it's called now, some kind of Dunn farm was theirs, and they were the people who introduced a breed of sheep, and I used to know this as well as I know my name, as a very popular breed now in the United States. They brought it from Scotland, and I will perhaps think of the name presently, but they were great sheep breeders and brought this breed into the country. As you go along Route 41, there's a magnificent, there are magnificent pin oak trees, and those were all planted by the Scovilles just as a gift to the town. And then Grassland Farms up the road away, now I think owned by, what is the name of those people?
Well, it used to be a vet.
Yeah, it used to be Hines, the vet, but I've forgotten who's there now. Well, it doesn't make any difference, but that was their cattle farm, and they had prize air shears, as I remember, and God, I wish I remembered the breed of sheep, but they, like a good many people of that sort, they had their own greenhouse, supply flowers for both houses daily, and there are still all those little houses with kind of second story front porches are all tenant houses belonging to the Scoville family. Now the potting shed and the fire shed and this shed and that shed has all been sold off, and they've been turned into very attractive small houses. Orlena Scoville was a hostess in the Grand Manor, and although this happened before I came on the scene, 1 year, contrary to her usual custom, because she generally spent the winters abroad or in their townhouse on 57th Street, or 58th, I guess it was, she had a series of entertainments for people, and she had, for example, Ted Shawn and his dancers come, and in the spring, this was the last thing she did, in early spring, in the beautiful formal gardens at Hill House, had these dancers perform. And then she had Virgil Thompson come up and give a musical lecture, and people of that sort. And so she was a person mightily interested in culture as well as just in her lavish hospitality. She was in the French Pavilion in the 36th World Fair and loved the meal she had, and asked to see the cook, and promptly hired the cook, who is turned out to be Elsa Knickerbocker. And Elsa came here as Orlena's cook. Orlena was the person that really put Bob Osborne on the map. Do you want to stop it? by having him come to Portugal and help with the restoration of the house. The Quinta is famous for its tiles, and he helped do that. But at the same time, it gave him leisure to do some of his own artwork. And before that, he had been a master at Hotchkiss, but it did not provide him with the opportunity to flex his own artistic muscles, so to speak. There's a house out on Twin Lakes that John McChesney used to jokingly call the house for fallen women, because Orlena bought the house and then sold it afterwards, but provided a home for unwed mothers in the days in which that was something that was a terrible stigma for the girl involved.
Were these local girls?
These were local girls, and she was a person full of quiet good works, and but I think the thing that impressed me most about her was her smartness and elegant taste. In her later years, she wore every evening she'd wear a caftan. She had normal clothes for streetwear and that sort of thing. But about any time after 5 or before she would appear for the cocktail hour, she would come down in one of these numerous caftans she had, and the most extraordinary of them was one that some poor woman in Barcelona did. She took this caftan, which was in velvet, and then cut out all the little curlicues of an old paisley shawl and applicate them on this in thread of gold. This was the most sensational thing I've ever seen. Orlena was not a beautiful woman. She was a striking-looking woman, but she had such marvelous taste that she knew how to take advantage of every feature, good or bad, she had. And I remember one of a striking piece of jewelry she had was a topaz that was about the size of a walnut, and that she used to wear on her hand and on her fingers. When she did appear in street clothes, her designer was Mem Bolche. And so you see that she lived elegantly. And for she, that particular family, and Elvia particularly, the people I knew best, I've only seen Margot once, and I don't know what her name is now. And then I know all the Warner children. Don and Jonathan are the only ones I really know well. But I have been a guest at Hill House for Christmas and other occasions, and family parties and birthday parties and celebrations, more times than I can remember. And each time was an elegant occasion, and of course, the house is marvelously furnished, and the well-trained servants, and it was a kind of life that I had never known before, and perhaps will never know again in its elegance. But I loved going there because, above all things, Orlena was hospitable, and she knew how to make everybody at home. She had just a slightly naughty touch to her. It was never vulgar, but it was just enough sometimes to be slightly titillating, if I can use that word. And she had myriad friends in all walks of life. But she was a marvelous person, and I'm grateful that I knew her.
Who were the portrait of the two Scoville sisters?
In the library.
Yes, which is which?
The taller of the two is Gracie, and the other is Edie. They were not beautiful women by any means, but they had such good taste and dressed so well that they were striking looking always. And I loved going out to Barack Matif Farm for dinner, because these two little women always had their evening purses with them, even in their own home, and they would occasionally powder their noses. And Edie had a way of taking out a powder puff and just sort of slamming it here, so it was kind of white clown-like appearance. But again, the family just had the greatest sense of hospitality, and course they did, had done all sorts of things for the town, and it's easy to say, of course they could afford it. I think they would have done it if they couldn't have afforded it, because that was just the nature of that family. And now I can go into one of their sort of lateral relations, Maurice Ferrucci. Would you like to?
Sure.
Okay, Maurice came from Brooklyn, and I think was not particularly proud of his heritage. He came from a Jewish family, and I think he felt in this community that perhaps it was better not to advertise that. He went to Yale at a very early age, and was graduated, I think, when he was 19 or at the most 20. And he went from New Haven to Cambridge, where he founded something called Mrs. was married in Cambridge for the first of five times, and his first wife was named Isabel Jennings, and he had two daughters, Betty Thatcher. Betty's recently been divorced from her husband, but Betty was just about the age of Elvia Scoville, his third wife, and then Peggy, the second daughter, whom I've never met, married Walton Green's son. And he was married to Isabel Jennings, who, at last account, was still alive. I suspect she's dead now. I haven't seen her daughter, Betty Thatcher, for two or three years, and her mother was very old and very sick at the time. I think she'd be well up in her 90s if she was still alive. He divorced her to marry Lizzie Brody. And Lizzie Brody was a professor at Vassar. And in those days, there was no mass turnpike. And so in going to Vassar to court Lizzie, he went on Route 44 part of the way, and that took him through Salisbury, and he was charmed with the town and had to leave Boston because he sold, among other work, Lady Chatterley's Lover under the counter in Boston. And that was a no-no, and he became persona non grata in Cambridge, Massachusetts. While he was in Cambridge, Dunster House was really an excellent place, and it was one of those old bookstores that not only sold excellent books. Maurice ran the best bookstore I've ever been in the entire world. Not that I've been in a lot of bookstores in a lot of places, but I've never even found one in England that could match this for just arousing one's interest and having such a wide variety of excellent selections. Anyway, to get back to Maurice, he had, while he was at Dunster House in Cambridge, a little coterie of authors like Conrad Aiken, Rachel Field. He published a couple of her books, Conrad Aiken's first books, Blackmore, the critic, and T.S. Eliot. He published a couple of T.S. Eliot works. Maurice had began to fall out of love, if that's the term, with Lizzie Brody, and sent her off to Europe one day, and as he took her, she was on the boat waving goodbye, said, "Incidentally, I'm suing for divorce." That was the kind of fellow he was, let his wives in on these things sort of at the last minute. She incidentally married Schumpeter, the great Harvard economist, and I used to see her quite often because she had a good friend by the name of Lucy Talcott, who was a famous teacher at Vassar, and Lucy Talcott had the house out in Taconic, which Isabella Baldwin now has. And that Maurice and Lizzie had owned that house, and in the divorce settlement the house went to Lizzie. He married Elvia, who was the daughter of the Herbert Scovilles, and this was a marriage that Orlena did not approve of at all, although women her dignity didn't go around making a great fuss about it, but she did demand that they, because Maurice had been married twice before, that they go to France. They were married in Paris, and somehow in that particular group, and in those days, if there were divorces, you got married out of the country, and somehow it seemed to make the thing seem a little bit better in the eyes of everyone. He was married to Elvia almost 18 years, and as Elvia used to say, she would have the longest term of office of any of his wives, and I guess she did. Maurice divorced Elvia to marry Virginia Russ. Virginia Russ was married to a man by the name of Barnett, and they were divorced, and then Virginia married Ferrari, as it was called, Ward, who was the widower of Muriel Elbert, whose family owned the island on Twin Lakes, and the Elberts were the people originally from Goshen. They had a large house in Hartford, but they were the people who founded the Torrington Company, and a very prosperous company that has been, I don't know about it today, but 20 years ago when I knew about, or before that I knew the Elberts, why it was a very prosperous firm indeed. After Virginia and Maurice were divorced, he married Betty Wonder, the widow of Charlie Wonder, and then Maurice died during that marriage, and Betty is still alive. And I have known all of Maurice's wives except the first. As a matter of fact, I was at his fourth wedding and stood up for him and Virginia, if that's the term that one uses. Well, so much for Maurice, except say that he ran just one of the best bookshops ever, and he was a difficult man and very strange man in many ways. But I also had spent very many very agreeable hours with him, and it was just another sort of ramification of the Scoville family, and whom I've known pretty well, Pete and Ann Scoville. Pete is Elvia's brother, who died just a year and a half ago, a man of great importance in the world, and had been in the CIA and then left, and very important in anti-nuclear business, and they have been always very, very kind to me. They have four children, Molly, one daughter who is married, and their oldest son, Tony Scoville. His first wife was Alistair Cook's daughter, and his second wife is Sally Ellsworth's daughter. And another interesting relationship in this family is that Ollie, Elvia, and Maurice's daughter, her first husband was Jacques Chinoux. Jacques had been married before to a woman whose second, after she and Jacques were divorced, she married Luther Loomis, who was a fairly well-known writer. And maybe it isn't Luther Loomis, but a man by the name of Loomis anyway. But that woman and Jack had four children, three sons and a daughter. And the daughter, Claudine, married Pete Scoville's son. Let's see what sons are there. Tommy, Tony, and Nikki. She married Nikki, and so somehow at one time Ollie was her cousin's wife's mother-in-law, as well as being her stepmother, some damn thing. I mean, it got to be awfully complicated, and I haven't really figured it out, but that marriage is broken up, and Ollie is no longer married to Jack, so that strange relationship doesn't exist. Going to stop in a minute. Now, is this the Madeline Beatty, her maiden name,
spelled
B-E-A-T-T-Y, and she's buried over in the Town Hill Cemetery, was divorced from, oh dear, what was his first name? And anyway, she, his last name was Mrs. Beatty Wilds, W-I-L-D-E-S, and she had been terribly ill early in her marriage, and a Canadian woman by the name of Isobel Sutherland, I-S-O-B-E-L, came along to be her nurse and then remained with her as her paid companion until Madeline's death, and then Isobel lived on 7 or 8 years later. They were.
When was this?
Isobel must have died in the late 50s or early 60s. I am not quite sure of those, thereabouts. And they had the house at the top of the hill that Mrs. O'Connor has, and the little red house at the bottom was the school house where Pete Minor went to school, grammar school. And that little red house.
Yes,
then,
what was the name of the school then?
It was just sort of the local grammar school. And one of Pete's teachers was Sadie Cleveland, who later married a Nickerson, and they are the Nickerson instruction people. And this Sadie Cleveland came from one of the oldest families in the town, the Cleveland family.
Now, excuse me.
Yeah.
This house is at the corner of Racetrack Road and Route 112.
That's right.
White
yeah,
house.
Yeah. That's and right. Yeah. And that was Madeline's house. They during the war they moved down to the little place because they stay away because they couldn't get fuel and one thing another for maintaining the larger house, and then they just stayed on. There they moved back a couple times, and toward the end of Madeline's life, they didn't even bother to move. That house has a kitchen that was never used because these two women ate all of their meals out, mostly at the old Salisbury Farms. And but they had a marvelous 1935 Buick Phaeton, and Isobel drove it, and they would they were notable in town for that car. It was black and it was always very well polished and a very beautiful car indeed. A lot of people wanted it. I don't know whatever did happen to the car eventually, but it was elegant. They would find local boys, usually occasionally a girl, and do very generous things for them. Madeline's family came from New Jersey and they manufactured rugs, but she was given to all sorts of most cockeyed cult-like things. And I remember going once there and a woman could see what were they called, but somehow little emanations over people's heads, and then she would draw them and Isobel would pay her for these, and you'd come away with one of these things, and if the colors were vivid it meant you were a new soul, and if they were sort of pale it meant you were an old soul and had gone through your cycles of lives and you were pretty soon going to be one with the infinite. I've really forgotten what the color of mine were, but as I remember it was rather garish, and I think they were rather more vivid than perhaps they should have been. They didn't indicate that I was a very old soul. Connie, somebody was that woman's name who did those things. But Isobel had a marvelous capacity for getting Madeline, for the kookiest people in the world around, and the two were called somewhat unkindly by locals as Madeline and Padlin. And but they were good citizens and generous people. They were great book readers. They bought lots of books and then gave them away. And they also, I know Russell Correll has a very soft spot in his heart for them because he started out in a very small way here in an antique shop. And they and the Donald Blagdens really kept him going. They purchased and spread news about his things, and he thinks very highly of them, as I do too. But I was more impressed by some of the kookiness than I was by anything else.
Haviland is not alive?
No, she's been dead now, I think, 10 or 12 years. She was Canadian, and she had six sisters, and so they're known as the Seven Sutherland Sisters. I think there was a dance group or something called the Seven Sutherland Sisters, too, but this wasn't they.
Who's in their house now?
I think someone who works for the Belchers. Oh. And Madeline had a funny way of getting terrible crushes on people and changing her will and then forgetting about the person changing her will. So far as I know, she really kept Tom Wagner doing a lot of business, because she was in and out changing her will almost monthly. But, that's what I remember about them, except their hats. They always wore hats. And even when they went to the Salisbury Farms, they were properly attired in hats. Not the latest hats, but in hats anyway. And I'd like to mention a little bit about the Cleveland family, and then I think probably I shall have given you enough for today, don't you?
Well, let's see.
They are a very old family here. I think there remains in the family now about 7 or 8 acres. They once owned a great deal of land, and this was land that was a crown grant. They moved in this town before 1741. I don't know, I think it was a couple of years before that. And they are not a family who have ever distinguished themselves particularly, except that they have that kind of Yankee ingenuity. They're awfully good mechanics, and one branch of the family, I think his name is Paul Cleveland, who was really quite an inventor, and he worked at Hotchkiss for a while. And
quite good with wood.
Yeah, and Dick Cleveland is marvelous with wood too. But I mention them just because they have been here for so many years, and the younger generation are around and vital. The house in which the DeMilles now live was built by Dick Cleveland's grandparents, and they were, his grandmother and his old maid aunt Annie were still living in it when I first came to Hotchkiss, and the mother and daughter fought terribly, and the old lady was deaf as a doorpost, and if the weather was right and the wind was coming from the south, you could hear him fight all the way up to the dormitories at Hotchkiss, and sometimes it was rather entertaining to hear him yelling at each other.
This is the first house after the Hotchkiss Corners going south towards Sharon.
Yeah.
First house on the right.
Yeah, yeah. And not a very old house, but there is a street in Lakeville named Cleveland Street, and the spelling of the name is the same spelling that President Cleveland's family originally had, but the newspapers, for some reason or other, started spelling his name without the A, and so they and the city adopted that spelling, but this is the old-fashioned spelling, and these people have retained it. I think they and the Bushnells are probably the oldest families in the town, and I think they would be the first to tell you they are not raggies, and it's a distinction they don't want to apply to them, and I don't blame them, because it's not particularly complimentary. The property in which the Hotchkiss Golf Course is laid originally belonged to a man by the name of Smith Cleveland, and then somehow that property passed into the hands of Mrs. Hotchkiss, and I don't know if she bought it or what happened, and she that was part of the original grant. The house on the intersection of 112 and 41, the house on the northwest corner, is still called Cleveland Cottage, the one in which the Hugheses live. And as I say, a family that hasn't been particularly distinguished. They never had the wealth of the Scovilles either, but they've been here for a very long time. And Dick Cleveland has a good many things in his possession that are very interesting, just mementos of the town and pictures and one thing and another, so he has a little sort of Salisbury Association all of his own in his house, and that these things are fun to see.
Okay, ready to go.
The first person I would like to talk about is Frank Ingraham, chiefly because I found him such a marvelous person. I suspect he spoke with a real old Connecticut accent. He had been born in Dover Plains, but that's close enough to the Connecticut border, so I think the accent that he had would qualify. It was one that I'd heard two or three other people speak with, and I think it's extinct. Now, he told me that his father was a drover, and he became Mrs. Beeler's chauffeur, and then became the school chauffeur. He was not Mrs. Beeler's coachman. She did have a coachman. He wasn't it, although people used to think he had been that. But for years he would drive the secretaries home, pick them up in the morning, and drive them home. But there were only three or four, and they were local people. He would pick up any kind of visiting lecturer at the trains and take them back, and they always picked up the Sunday preacher and took him back if that was necessary. The preacher didn't come under his own steam. In those days, a good many people came to Millerton by train, and Frank would always be there to meet them. He was full of stories, and never once did he ever tell a story that was even bordered on being smutty, and they were all terribly funny stories, and ones that one could tell one's most priggish maiden aunt. He loved to tell a story about driving Dr. Beeler, Father Sill, and a third clergyman someplace, and he apologized for telling this because he was such a discreet servant he did not report what had gone on in the car, but he disabused him so he thought he could tell it, and I think George Stone will be interested in this. The third clergyman looked at Father Sill, who was in his Holy Cross habit, and looked at him and said, "You dress like mother, but they call you father." Not a very gracious, but a very fundamentalist Protestant approach for Father Sill. But Frank was full of stories of that sort, and just old-time amusing anecdotes. As I said, were never anything but in terribly good taste and awfully funny. Toward the end of his life, he was in a Masonic home down in Wallingford, I think that's where it was. But he died a rather old man and had been around since the very early days of the school. He was employed just about the time the Beelers came on the scene. Another man who was extraordinary was John Cardoza, who was head groundsman. He walked about as fast as any man I've ever seen, and he worked along with his men from sunup to sundown. He was given carte blanche at Hotchkiss. John Cardoza could do just about what he wanted, and the result is a very beautiful campus with some marvelous trees that most schools can't boast of. I remember one morning after an electrical storm coming along and noticing that a Japanese temple tree, we had two of them there on either side of those bow windows in the old building, this one was near the headmaster's office, had been struck by lightning and really split right down the middle. There were beautiful trees that looked something like a mountain ash, but a much larger tree, and the only place I've ever seen another Japanese temple tree is in the public garden in Boston. This tree was completely riven, and so it was killed, and I was the one who broke the news to Mr. Cardoza, and I think had he been a married man and I told him that his entire family had been killed, he he wouldn't have reacted as quite as strongly as he did about this tree. It really devastated him. And then when the new main building came in, the other tree was right in the way, and the school tried valiantly to transplant it, you remember that, but it died. We were the first people to have ginkgo trees around because of John Cardoza. And one of the prettiest spots, I think, on the campus is that avenue of English elms that go down to Hoyt Field. And the avenue that goes down to Hoyt Field. And that was all John's planning. He didn't have a degree in architectural landscaping or anything of the sort. He's just a natural gardener, and a superb one. I remember with some affection Susan and Victor Blanco. Susan was Scottish and weighed about 6,000 pounds. Victor was Spanish, I guess, and I don't know whether his parents came from Spain, I don't think he did, and a rather small man, but he was the cook, and Susan was a champion babysitter in Litchfield County, and she was like a good many of the people, they were either Scots or Irish. There were a lot of Irish maids, and they worked for practically nothing. I'm thinking of Lila McQuaid, for example, who was a very sweet person. And, of course, in later years, the den mother of all these was not, with these maids, was not Irish, but Elizabeth Kate, who really was an awful old troublemaker. And she had set her cap for Harry Jones, who was bachelor business manager of the school, and never succeeded, and apparently she was a real nuisance to him. She embarrassed him, and he eventually married Helen Lorigan, who had been his secretary at Hotchkiss, and after his retirement in 1946, 47, Harry retired in 1947, they were married. And I'm getting a little ahead of myself as far as school health is concerned. There were a wonderful old couple from Lancashire by the name of the Stevensons, and they spoke with a lovely Lancashire accent, and they were the sort of custodians, and I use that word advisedly, of Beeler Hall. She was the maid and he was the houseman, and those people took such pride in their work. They came in when the building was new in 1935 or 6, or whenever that building was built, and were there until their retirement, and they were superior people. But it was just extraordinary, the devotion they gave to the Hotchkiss School. Margaret Hogan, perhaps, was the most interesting of all of these old-time servants at Hotchkiss. She was Irish, and she had took care of bachelor masters at the school, and she was famous for kind of earthiness, but she was a very loving sort of person. And when they were building Memorial Hall, she went in and supervised the building of the toilet where they put toilet fixtures, because Mr. Murphy was going to live there, and Mr. Murphy was such a tiny man, and that she had told him where to put the toilet paper receptacle, among the others, so he could reach it conveniently. So her interest in people was very thorough, and remember two or three others, but there was a woman called Julie who cleaned the cleaning men, the houseman's rooms. And I had a houseman by the name of, tell me about his name, maybe it'll come to me, but he had been rich New York person's valet. And he came to work at Hotchkiss because he retired up here. He had a niece with whom he came to live. And when I would go away on weekends, rarely happened, but he always packed my bag and unpacked it. And he would have shined my shoes and brushed my coats if I had permitted him to do it, but not having been used to any kind of servant, it seemed to me unfair to let this man treat me that way. Bliss, his name is Bliss, now I remember, and it was blissful to have him as a houseman, and he put my laundry away, and he took it down to the laundry, and he was just a terribly nice person with very good sense and good manners. I suppose there are other of the help that I should recall, but they all lived in Bissell Hall. And Bissell Hall is a school building. Its only function was that it was the old Bissell Hall study, as you well remember, it was still going. And the building was the residence of numerous cats, and the odor was perfectly dreadful. But somehow these people managed to live there without complaining very much about that. And they all ate in the school, in the basement, in the old dining room, or in the kitchens, and in the new dining room. They had their dining room down there, and there was a great separation of help gradations. We would help in the basement, secretaries at a different time, but upstairs, and then the faculty and students at yet another time. So there was a great deal of social gradation.